Well, hello, everyone. Good to see you. I will go around and say hello to folks before we get started. Starting with Alex, Bob K, Cody, Mark, Yeshitsuki, Paulette, Pat, Shoketsu, Paula, Erica, Marv, Mary, Sam, and a giant jellyfish, John, Jim, Amelia, Bob O, Karen, Jeff, Sabrina, Tyler, and Ruth Ann. Welcome, everyone. Let's see. We had a lovely retreat this last week. There was always at least two people physically in the zendo, usually three and sometimes four. And much of the time we had usually between 4 and 12 people on the Zoom as well. And it was a very, very sweet and I think successful trial run of our hybrid community. Those of us in the Zendo felt very supported by the presence of the people on Zoom. It was great. I mean, sometimes there was only two of us, and that would have been a little hard, except that then we could look up on the TV screen and there's six people who have joined us. So it was sweet. And then the Zoom folks said it was nice to have that sense of groundedness in the Zendo. So I look forward to that. I did feel very, very sad leaving the Zendo at the end of the retreat and thinking, oh, I just want people to come back. Although I do think it was significant that even though the Zendo was open for as many as 10 people to participate, that so few people, ended up taking that option. And I think it's a reflection of this COVID situation that still exists and is even worse in Oregon right now than it has been throughout the whole pandemic. But I am toying with, different possibilities, like maybe a few of us sign up so that there's, three or four people in the Zendo. And then, if there's nobody in the Zendo but me, I might as well just host from home, right? But if maybe we just set it up so that there's going to be a few people, and then we'll go kind of host from the Zendo. So that might be sweet, because it felt like our Zendo had been really neglected. It was covered with cobwebs. Like you'd be walking along and just like your cobweb would get in your face, and it was dusty, and all the candles were used up, and all this stuff. So we cleaned it and got everything. So it feels like a Zendo again. So I would love to maintain that. So stay tuned about that. I think the main things coming up is the term student program. And if anyone, I don't know, if maybe Mark, if you can look up the link to the term student program on the website and share that in the chat, that would be great. So it's also referred to in the newsletter. It's just a great way, especially if we're, all at a distance, to connect and create Sangha and get to know one another better. So it starts on September 11th, I believe. And there's an opening retreat on that day, and there's a closing retreat at the end of November, very beginning of December. And And those are the that's the minimum thing. And then in between, you tie that all together with vows of practice that you decide on. So they're appropriate to your life, your interests, etc. And then we, the people who sign up for that program, get to know one another over the course of that term to whatever extent is possible via Zoom retreats, right? But you know, we share our vows with each other, and that usually many of us find that's enough to provide more support for our intention over the course of that term. So I encourage you to think about signing up for that. And you should have been involved. I like to say that, you know, you want to have had a regular practice with the Sangha for a few months. First, not so much to be exclusive, but just I find that if people don't have that the program doesn't really work because it's too much. It's like you kind of have to build that basis of just, you know, some regular participation with the Sangha, and then you add the term student vows. But go ahead and email me if you have any questions or wonder whether it's for you. Any other things that anybody can think of that I should announce or questions? All right. So today, my talk is shifting the self-narrative of inadequacy to a self-narrative of abundance. So, whether we are conscious of it or not, we all live with a self-narrative. Even if we are a great Buddhist and we've been practicing for a long time and we try to see through or drop our narrative, I mean, that's just it's part of being human, is we have this consciousness that tries to make sense of things. So we live with a self-narrative, who we are, what our tendencies are, etc. And we start forming this early in childhood. We learn our name. We learn, I am a girl or I am a boy. So and so is my dad. So and so is my mom. And for better or worse, those around us help us establish a sense of ourselves as an individual, a unique individual. I'm tall. I'm short. I'm a good eater. I get whiny on long car rides. I love swimming. I'm good at drawing. I'm not very smart. You know, like we start picking these messages up from people. And then based on our preferences, we expand our list of likes and dislikes, and with which we, you know, we base more and more of our decisions on. I hate olives. I love pizza. I love playing soccer. I hate homework. And based on our positive or negative experiences in getting our needs met, or success or failure in things that we attempt to do, we develop a sense of ourselves in relationship and compared to other people. I don't fit in with most people. Lots of people like me. I'm fun to be around. I'm a capable and a capable asset to any team. Or I'm usually a disappointment to others. Or I'm socially awkward or whatever. And over the course of our lives, over the decades, we maintain our self-narrative, probably expanding it, elaborating on it, refining it, and sometimes very occasionally rewriting it. So the vast majority of us, and I would venture to say all of us, but that's not something I can verify. But if I had to guess, I would say all of us, to a greater or lesser extent, end up composing a self-narrative that includes a significant sense of inadequacy. And sure, there might be aspects of ourselves that we are confident about, or at least not bothered by. And we all have things we know we're pretty good at, things that we're proud of doing or having done. And we don't expect to be good at everything or to have everything. But sooner or later, we learn our fatal flaws. Some of us are brutally introduced to them through bad parenting, cruelty, or trauma in our early lives. Sometimes it's later challenges and failures that wake us up to our limitations. Troubled relationships, loneliness, mental health issues, rejection, betrayal, unemployment, unfulfilled ambitions, a general pervasive sense of disappointment. So our narrative comes to include the fact, quote unquote, that at least relatively speaking, we are physically unattractive, not very smart, not very knowledgeable or well-informed, or not skillful with people, not a good leader, I'm not athletic, easily overwhelmed, emotionally oversensitive, reactive, judgmental, not great at intimacy, the list goes on. Even if our self-esteem is fairly good, somewhere in our self-narrative is the sense that we're not one of the chosen few. We're not one of those people who is going to play a significant role in the affairs of the world. We're not one of those people who goes around and brightens the lives of everyone that we come in contact with, like the Dalai Lama. We're not one of those people who are going to achieve awakening or enlightenment. We're not one of those people who are going to contribute something remarkable and beautiful and lasting to the world. Or if we do have in our self-narrative a little, we do think maybe we're meant to be one of the chosen few. Chances are good that as the years and the decades pass, the thought starts to occur to us that maybe we've failed in that regard. We were meant to be one of the chosen few, but we didn't step up to the plate. So, and it may be that the self-narrative of inadequacy, which can be subtle, is worse in modern times. We can speculate about why that is, what aspects of our culture make that worse. But I suspect this is not just a modern phenomenon, because something that I have talked about before is one of the main messages of the Lotus Sutra, the Buddhist text that we don't even know who wrote it. It appeared it was compiled around the first century CE, so 2000 years ago. And one of the main parables told in the Lotus Sutra, many of you will have heard this before, is that of the lost son. So it talks about a son who, I'm thinking like early teens, he takes off, he's rebellious, he takes off, leaves home. And he wanders around and around and gets up to no good. He lives kind of a dissolute lifestyle. He kind of forgets where he comes from. He's not in a good way. In the meantime, his father has become a very wealthy, powerful person. And he misses his son. This is his only son, his only heir. And he wonders where his son is, and he's worried that he's dead and whatever. So then the son comes back. He wanders back into his father's realm and doesn't even recognize his father. He doesn't recognize his home. But the father recognizes the son. And the father is excited and he goes up to the son, but the son is terrified. He thinks he's just going to be like arrested or put in jail or, you know, something like that. So he runs away. And the father recognizes his son has ended up with a view of himself that is so low that he cannot he cannot accept where he came from. He cannot accept that he is an heir to this wealth. So the father goes through a series, you know, many years of skillful means of hiring the son to do menial work and kind of promoting him and getting to know him. And then eventually he has enough of a relationship with the son that he's able to say publicly, this is my son and my heir. And the son is able to step into that. So of course, this is a parable. This is as a metaphor, a story reflecting our own sense of ourselves. So when it's predicted that all beings are capable of Buddhahood, we think like the lost son, nah, you know, not me. But the point is, yes, it is, this is our inheritance in a sense, and it doesn't matter. But we may have to go through a process of recognizing what our true nature is and building this kind of self-confidence, or like I'm saying today, rewriting our self-narrative of one from one of inadequacy and into one of abundance. So I'll explain more. But of course, in Zen, as many of you know, one of the things that we're trying to recognize is this narrative is just a narrative. It's just a story we tell about ourselves. And it doesn't reflect an inherent reality. I mean, a narrative is a thing. It has its own reality in a sense, but it's not what we think it is. It's not the truth in and of itself. So in a way, you could think of it as being a gloss for life. So a gloss, a noun, can be a brief explanation of a difficult word or expression or concept. So it's just like a little summary. And inherent in that definition is that you're taking something complex and you're just, you know, glossing it over, to use the other aspect of this word, which means kind of dealing with it kind of lightly, summarizing, perhaps even being deliberately misleading. So our narratives, you might think, as being a gloss for our lives, which are actually incredibly complex and impossible to summarize at all, let alone neatly. And who are we really? We're a culmination of causes and conditions. Biological evolution, cultural evolution, the choices of our parents. Where did they have us? Where did they move? Grandparents, you know, at what point did our ancestors migrate from one place to another, thereby totally affecting who we are, our further ancestors' genetics, family of origin experience, schooling, social responses to our unique physical, emotional, and mental manifestation, which is very culturally specific, culturally and time specific. So if anything, we are our reality of ourselves, our body, mind, emotions, is really more like a stew, I think, than a narrative. And in Zen, we call this self-situation our karmic package. So it's the result of many causes in the past. Many of them were our own choices, but many of them were not. But the story doesn't end there. We also say this karmic package that we have, our personality, our body, our experiences, our memories, our desires, is only our conventional self, not our truest self at all. So based on our human conceptions and on other religions, you might then assume that your body and mind and all that stuff isn't your real self because you have a soul. That's your real self. A pure, ethereal, spiritual, disembodied, non-material essence that is nonetheless yours and yours alone, which animates you, and perhaps it flies up to heaven when your physical body dies. But according to Buddhism, we don't have a soul either. So what is our real self? We say our real self nature is no self nature. Ultimately, only this moment, right here, right now, exists. In this moment, we are riding the wave of causation, each in our own unique karmic package, alive, breathing, perceiving, growing, dying, learning, forgetting. And there is no unchanging, independent, enduring essence inside us. And the wonderful thing is, there doesn't have to be. We assume there has to be some kind of self-essence. That's the only thing that makes sense. And we want there to be some kind of self-essence, because it's kind of unnerving to think we're just a collection of karmic results in a state of flux. What do we hold on to? Through practice, we can explore what it really means to have a true self nature that is no self nature. It's not scary. It's freeing. It's not a nihilistic void. It's incredibly intimate. Because we still exist. We're still very much alive, even though we're empty of any inherent, unchanging self nature. It might be better to say our self is boundless. And the experience of this is more like realizing the whole universe is yourself, as opposed to realizing you have no self. So what does all of this no self nature talk have to do with rewriting our self narrative of inadequacy? Well, for one thing, if you don't have an inherent, enduring, independent self essence, who is there to blame for your inadequacy? Who is inadequate? So our karma verse from the precepts is, all harmful karma ever committed by me since of old, on account of my beginningless greed, anger, and ignorance, born of my body, mouth, and thought, now I atone for it all. So we say this karma is beginningless. Who is to blame for it? You know, even if you believe in this individual self, if we were formed by our parents and our culture, then they're the parents to blame. But how were they treated? How were they raised? What about their parents? Like, where, how far back do we have to go before we can lay the blame? But that karma is carried in this package, in this, it's carried forward through our body, mouth, and thought. So we take responsibility for it. Okay, the buck stops here. What are we going to do now? But we can do that without a sense of blame or shame. As Pema Chodron says, start where you are. And we may not particularly like this karmic package we ended up with, but if we can work on radical acceptance of it, that can unlock the way forward. But our true self nature has further implications. And this is the main implication I want to talk about today. It goes beyond freeing ourselves from shame and blame. Being like, you know, what self is there to blame? This is a flow. I'll do my best from here on out. So that is very freeing. But we can rewrite our self-narrative to include our Buddha nature, which is another way to describe our true, ungraspable, indescribable, boundless self-nature. So here's the essence of this alternate and ultimately truer self-narrative. While the small self against the world is always inadequate, the boundless self with the world is a conduit of abundance. The irony is that when we serve as a conduit for abundance, it's our unique and limited individual bodies and minds that serve as the conduit. There is no other way. So again, that is the small self against the world is always inadequate. The boundless self with the world can be a conduit for abundance. But that conduit is our karmic package. So it shifts from the karmic package trying to be responsible and generate everything to I'll allow myself to be used by the universe. And what this means is that when we get stuck in our self-narrative of inadequacy, we're breaking a precept. We're breaking the 10th grave precept. Do not disparage the three treasures, which are Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. The positive phrasing of that is honor the Buddha, unfold the Dharma, nourish the Sangha. So when we're stuck in our self-narrative of inadequacy, which feels deceptively useful, it seems like our responsibility to dwell on our inadequacy and try to fix it. But when we get stuck in that, we are disparaging the Buddha because we're saying, nah, not me. The Buddha can't flow through me. I am too inadequate. And we're generally shrinking back from unfolding the Dharma and nourishing the Sangha. So what's essential here is recognizing we are not simply replacing a self-narrative of inadequacy with a self-narrative of adequacy. The small self against the world is always inadequate. Any narrative of adequacy will end up unraveling or being very fragile and superficial. So what does it mean to rewrite our self-narrative in a way that accounts for our Buddha nature? Can you conceive of yourself as being no different than the Buddhas and ancestors? Can you conceive of yourself as being that son who has a rightful inheritance? Can you conceive of yourself as being no different from me, a so-called Zen teacher? No different from the Dalai Lama or Thich Nhat Hanh or anyone else you really admire. Can you conceive of yourself as being a potential conduit for great generosity, acceptance, love, and strength at any time, in any situation? We are naturally and spontaneously generous when we feel a sense of abundance. When we know not only that we have all that we need, but resources to spare and a sense that there is genuine need around us, confident that the gifts that we offer will be received. And when we're able to do this, then we say the three wheels of giver, receiver, and gift are one. Who benefits who, right? It feels so wonderful to give in that way. So wonderful to just, you know, be this conduit for abundance and, you know, have it received. But much of the time we hold back, thinking no one will want to hear our thoughts or ideas. No one wants or needs our expressions of love or appreciation or encouragement. We think the world doesn't really need us. We can sit back and watch it from the sidelines, observing the chosen few playing the game. And I think this is a tragic misunderstanding for the sake of ourselves, but also for the world. I mean, when you think about it, when has somebody, you know, taken the time to say something sincerely appreciative to you? Saying, you know, Pat, I thought you did a wonderful job at that event. Thank you so much for everything you gave. I mean, who doesn't like that, right? Do you ever go like, Pat, I wanted that compliment from someone else? Like, that always feels good. And somebody shows up to help, sticks around to help you clean up, offers to contribute. I know, hasn't that always made the world seem like a better place, even if you don't avail yourself of that assistance? Or when someone sincerely offers their thoughts and feelings and observations with an attitude of humility, not of, I'm getting on my soapbox, so now listen to me because I'm so smart, right? It's not coming from a place of self-adequacy. It's an offering. You know, when have you ever had a negative reaction to that, or even a judgmental reaction to that? I feel like that's what happens often when we do our way-seeking mind talks and a senior student just offers something. They, you know, this is my life. This is some of the things that I've learned. And when it's offered in that open-handed way, it's just so inspiring and beautiful. So the practice around this that I would recommend, I mean, we can approach this from two ways. And one is working on our sense of self, which that is maybe, you might say, the bulk of our Zen practice. Study, meditation, mindfulness is trying to, I like to say, we're working on having less of a sense of self, because it's not a dualistic thing, right? It's not like I'm totally caught in my tiny self narrative, or I'm like transcendently free of all thoughts of self. But we can make that sense of self softer. We can question that narrative more, be less compelled by it. So that's what a lot of our practice is working on that. But there's another way to approach this as well. So I would say that is working on realization, working on our understanding, and then we enact that in our actions. But there's another way to approach it, which is to enact this and then have it verified. And then that can lead to realization. So if we act as if, I matter in this situation. If we act as if I am needed, if we act as if what I say or do can make a difference, and we do this in this this sense of allowing abundance to flow through. It's not something we own. It's not something, you know, I matter in the small self way of like, well, I am so much smarter and capable than all of these people that I'm going to contribute my opinion. I'll make a difference. But it is going to come through you, right? It is going to be your idea. It's going to be your opinion. But if it's offered in this way of flow, you know, it doesn't matter in a way where everybody agrees or thanks you or anything. It's just an offering. So if we start to just do this, then what happens? So my big example of this, and I think we'll find that it feels right. So this is my example. Like you could become a physicist and study gravity and start to understand how gravity works. Or you could be a gymnast and you could work with gravity with your body and learn how to move with it so that you will know. You don't have to like produce an equation to tell you what position on the balance beam is going to work. You find it and you know it works. I'm balanced. There it is. So it's a verification through our own direct experience. So my example of this is, and I mean, you may not perceive this about me because of my unique role in the Sangha, but I generally don't have a sense of myself as being very socially capable or interesting or skilled. I, you know, awkward, not introverted per se, but, you know, conversation with strangers, what do I say? I don't necessarily think that I can relate that well. So I'm inclined to just be kind of in uncomfortable situations, as I think most of us, just kind of quiet, self-contained and observing and whatever. But when I am in the role of Zen teacher, Sangha leader here or in person at the Zendo, I am just going from the assumption that you showed up and you would love for the teacher to say hi. You would love for the teacher to come over and be interested in you. That you would love to hear my ideas. And so I operate in a very different way. And I find like people do. People. So it's that confirming thing. And yet this is an artificial situation where I am the teacher, so it's kind of easy. But what if I walked into Winco, the grocery store, with the same attitude? What if every person that I passed or encountered, I thought, boy, you know, I may be busy at the moment, but, you know, if I have a chance, I'm sure they would love for me to, you know, smile at them or help them out. Or it's a very different way of viewing ourselves in relation to other beings. So I just suggest trying this on and entering situations where you might be withholding or, you know, because of that sense of inadequacy, a sense that you're not really needed. And just trying to offer in this really open-handed way. And it needs to be, I would say, to work, it needs to be a open-handed gift, right? no strings attached, no expectations of like, oh, and then I totally transformed someone's day, or everybody loved my idea, or whatever. It is an offering, and as long as it is an open-handed offering, it doesn't matter how it is received, but it oftentimes will be positively received. So I guess, oh yes, I want to tell another story. And I think it's difficult to practice this kind of innocence. When it's sincere, it's very easy. But so I have a dear Dharma sister friend. We practiced together at Dharma Rain Zen Center, starting 25 years ago. And I felt a real resonance with her from the beginning, and I assumed that she felt the same about me. Like, I just thought it was like, yeah, we really hit it off. So when she actually lives down in Eugene, and when she would drive up to Portland and I would see her, I would be like, ah, Sato, and I would go over, and which isn't typically what I do with people, but I thought, all right, we've got this thing going on. So I was like, Sato, it's great to see you. I had this warm response. And it turns out that at least at first she was like, what? Why is she coming over to me like this? Like, what's going on? She didn't, start off with that. It's not like she disliked me, but she didn't have that sense of immediate comfort. But because I approached her that way, she just went along with it, which I think is so funny and sweet. Like, if I had known, if somehow somebody had said, oh, I don't know, I don't know, she's not really sure about you yet, I probably would have totally withdrawn. I probably would have been like, oh, I won't bother her then. And then, who knows if our friendship would have happened. But because it was just this, I don't know, what would I always think about that too. Like, think of how dogs greet us. What if we greeted each other? I'm not suggesting it, but what if we greeted each other in that way? What if everybody who came through the Zendo door, I greeted like my dog Suka greets them. Hey, good to see ya. I'm so excited to see ya. All right, so I'll leave it there. Comments or questions, observations, stories. Feel free to, the easiest thing is if you raise your hand electronically using the reactions button on Zoom. So then I, you can queue up that way, or but you can also physically raise your hand or just unmute yourself. Mark.
So just over the last couple of days, I've been playing with the metaphor of art versus design, where design is making a thing that's useful and also beautiful, but art is just making a thing that's beautiful for the sake of making a thing that's beautiful. And your talk today really spoke to me because there's this way in which we're the painter, but we're also the palette. And we're also the canvas. But it brings up a question for me, which is, your palette may have a lot of blue on it, or your palette may have a lot of green on it right now, right? So there's the question of what to do when you're trying to paint trees and your palette has a lot of blue on it. Right? Because we don't get to pick what's on the palette. So go paint something else or paint the best trees you can with the limited green you've got. There's this question about how to live skillfully with this bundle of stuff. Any thoughts?
Well, and that's where I think it can be frustrating and disappointing that our spiritual practice doesn't give us neat answers, but it also seems entirely legitimate. Like, what kind of authentic path would just give you pat answers? So I think there's a tension between that I think you point out perfectly, which is making the offering with what you have, responding with what you have, just for the sake of, you know, being a conduit. And then there is the question of, you know, where might my talents be best used? Where is the greatest need? What would be useful in this situation? You know, there's a aspect of skillfulness that we're still asked to engage. So, you know, my example recently is really pondering what I'm going to do next in my climate activism. And on the one hand, it's like, well, you know, follow my heart, do what seems to come most naturally for me. Okay, you know, that is good and that's part of it, but also what is needed? And like finding that place where they line up is not that straightforward. It's like, and it's a process, I think. But what I've learned to do at least is recognize the process, and recognizing, okay, right now I'm at this stage. And when there is an alignment, just really enjoying that. Really like, yes, all right. I mean, and it's not going to last forever. Things change, capacities change. But when there is an alignment, when we find something that we can do, the way that we can give, a way that we can manifest, you know, that was one of the greatest joys, I think.
Thank you.
Paula.
As I look back on, you know, my life and what I do, I was, you know, my narrative that I inherited was based on living in an urban environment and working in offices and businesses. And I end up living on a farm with rescued horses and ponies and cats and dogs, and feel really very much at home. And follow my heart doing that. Sometimes I've asked myself, how did I end up with this? Like, what happened? How did I end up doing this? And I don't know. I just followed my feeling. I just followed my instinct. I just fell into it. I took riding lessons because I wanted to be near horses because they seemed so free, and I was stuck in my car commuting and I didn't like the way they were treated, and I volunteered at a rescue and she couldn't get their hooves trimmed, so I took a course. And the other day, a few weeks ago, a stray cat showed up at my door, and he was unhandleable and feral and a barn kitten, an overpopulation problem down the road. And he ended up here, and I thought, what am I going to do? I, you know, James passed away. I can't afford to get him fixed. And my new dog that I took in started licking him outside. And it was just a spontaneous connection between these two animals that was immediate and spontaneous and not overthought and in the body. And as Shiloh was licking him, I could reach down and pat this cat, and he accepted my help. So I took him in and I shared his story, and a rescue has him and he's fine. And I looked at him and I thought, I started overthinking. I can't help you. I'm nobody. I can't help you. Why, if I go away, go to another farm, somebody else will feed you. And he kept coming here, and he and the dog would look for each other when I took the dog out. So I looked at him and I thought, he needs help. He's begging for food. He's begging for shelter. It will be winter here soon. So he's safe and comfortable and happy and adored in his new home. And they just watching the animals, it just showed me like this spontaneous connection between this 60-pound dog and this feral cat. Just taught me, like, just pay attention. Forget yourself and do what needs to be done here. Do what I can do. Ask for help and allow. And so that in his mind, the world changed for him. You know, in his mind, his whole world, in his body for that cat, his whole world is now safe and happy and content.
Thank you for sharing that story.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, sometimes when we're at that point of, you know, where we feel like maybe we've lost touch with our heart or what we should do, or it don't see around us necessarily how we might be able to respond or give or contribute. I don't know. It seems like a good thing to try is just something new. You just kind of never know what is going to open up. Just a new spot, a new class, a new hobby, a new, I don't know, a new relationship, a new friendship. But stepping out just a little bit so that the kind of the universe can come your way. Mm-hmm. So I think sometimes if we stay in one place too long, like we kind of lose that, shut ourselves off a little bit from the requests that we might be able to respond to and realize, like, that's something I could. That's and it's something like, what do we notice? My teacher told me a story about being at the monastery, and she was really annoyed because when they assigned cleaning tasks, they assigned all these different tasks, but they never assigned anybody to clean the windows. And so the windows were getting all like dirty, and she was like, and at some point, I don't know if her teacher pointed this out or she just kind of dawned on her. She realized that was what she could do. She could clean the windows. She's the one who noticed the windows needed cleaning. And so that's what she could give. And maybe nobody was going to notice, but she would notice. Brian?
So I wanted to say thank you for this and for last week as well. I had been spending some time thinking about where in my life I might have glimpsed the independent dimension of reality that you were describing before. And I recalled an incident. I didn't recall the incident. I recalled having been told about the incident when I was in a high chair, and a woman who came to help clean the house came, and she was a woman who had a hard life. And when she walked through the door, I just spontaneously blurted out, "Hello, Julie," with a big smile. And the you know, was, I don't know how old I was, but I was a toddler. And, you know, I thought, you know, maybe that would have been the first, you know, sort of just where there was this pure connection to another person in that opportunity. And it came to mind when you were describing how a sense of abundance can lead to generosity. And so I'm thinking, well, you know, whence this sense of abundance? And, you know, is it contingent on the circumstances in which we find ourselves? Or hearkening back to yet another Dharma talk, is it really rooted in a sense of hope and faith and the courage, you know, maybe to be open to those in ourselves. So anyway, so it's, I just wanted to say thank you for, you know, that line of thinking over the last couple of weeks that I found particularly fruitful.
Yeah, that's a whole dimension that I guess I didn't really go into. Okay, that sense of abundance, but where is this? And that's why I like the, you know, the imagery, which is not unique to Zen, of just like this being a conduit for, so the abundance doesn't come from us. So I don't know. It's difficult to do, right? Because I think most of us, when we think about generosity, we think about like, oh crap, I hope I don't overcommit. You know, like, oh, because we can have a sense of being stressed. We've overcommitted, we can't follow through, everybody has expectations of us. And there's a sense of stress and lack of abundance there. So it's, but I suspect, not that I say I've mastered this, but that when we just kind of get that self out of the way and we're, you know, being a conduit for this energy, which again in Aikido was exactly that, right? Coordinating mind and body, and like the energy is just flowing and we're usually blocking it, but now we're letting it flow. So when we're like that, I suspect that there will be a natural wisdom there in terms of what we are capable of offering. That we won't have to overthink it, like Paulo is talking about, right? Like, I don't know, do I have enough? Do I have enough time or money? Or I don't know, if I do that, then. But that there will be a little bit more of a, hey, I've got an extra sweatshirt. I mean, it's just, you know, something that will be more appropriate. But it's not easy. Yeshe Tsoki.
Back to Mark's colors, is that sometimes someone else might want to color you a certain color, but that's not the color, that's just a color, and you have a whole palette of colors that for that moment, for whatever reason they have, they only want to define you as a color. And I had that happen recently at work with someone who's just been in this specific position for a couple of weeks. He's been there for a long time, but this specific position for 2 weeks. He's brutish, he's rude, he's impolite, he's condescending. And he wanted me to do something differently, but it's not up to me to decide. It's up to the people he works with. And if I didn't do it, he was gonna go to the supervisor and have me fired. And I spoke to one of the people on his team who said he would talk to him, and he did. He says he wasn't much better with me. But the bottom line is three other people who really appreciate me and see my whole palette, they don't see me as just a color, supported me. And there's a Lakota way where you're in the Peace Chief Lodge. You see, where can you compromise and never make war except in innocence? And so, yes, this person who was talking to me was extraordinarily unskillful. However, the rest of us, and with these other people's support, we said, how can we make this work? and how can we keep Sidria safe? And that's what they did. And so then I was trying to say, I wanted to step up to the plate and just say hi in a positive way to this other person. I wasn't able to do that without having my gut go into a knotted, wadded twist. But I'm in that place now where, oh yeah, I have the support. I have all these people who see my full range of colors. I see that now too. Thank you for their eyes to help reflect it back to me. And I'm ready to go in and say hi to this guy. And it doesn't matter what his response is. It's matter how I am coloring myself and the canvas that I'm presenting and the colors that I am showing up with, regardless how he wants to muddy my colors.
I like it. You made me think of how just how the abundance is coming through like that, that the challenges the can also just kind of flow through like that when we're not trying to deal with them as a small self, but opening up to that sense of more abundance. And you know, you might not have even noticed that you had this support if you were really focused on just yourself.
And it's also so, for me, it's been so different from other situations where I'm with bullies and people just throw me under the bus. These people definitely rallied up and I said, wow, the universe is really supporting me here. I need to embrace that and welcome it and drink it.
Thank you very much for everyone who shared. Ruthann, did you want to say something? Oh. You just muted yourself. I just assumed because you're unmuted.
All the examples were great. And with the Buddha, I mean, he stepped out of the rigid laws of his time for, you know, his self growth and what he needed to do. But so that's one of the precepts, is to be creative, you know, be the individual in the unfolding of the Dharma. So I'm looking for a quote religion that was neat and tidy. That's what I love about Buddhism, is, you know, embracing and letting, being open. Thank you for all of this and for the Sangha.
So I should probably, yes, I know you raised your hand. I'm going to let people go with the verse, but I can stay on for a little bit. So if you want to continue the conversation, abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha, all Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita.